international finance. International finance, markets, crisis and law. We want to understand the structure and operation of the international financial system. We can review that through each of these key slides, which explains all of the key markets and the structure and operation of the system, as well as identifying a number of the key significant trends in this area. We are looking at the international financial system. We basically have two worlds. We have an underlying global mercantile economy and effectively a separate financial economy. This emerged in particular since the early 1970s with the collapse of the earlier Bretton Woods system of managed exchange rates, which was set up in Washington, New Hampshire, in America, in July 1944, just before the end of the Second World War. We established a new international order based on three key ideas at the Bretton Woods Treaty. We would establish the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, to manage international monetary stability. We would create an International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, which is now referred to as the World Bank Group, to promote development finance across the world. And then we were also going to create an International Trade Organization, an ITO, that was rejected by the American Congress, and therefore we adopted the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the GATT, in place of that until we established the World Trade Organization in 1985. We essentially designed a new international framework after the Second World War to create stability in the international financial system. That was specifically based on a gold exchange standard, which meant that we fixed the value of the United States dollar to gold at $35 per ounce, and then the value of all of the other currencies in the world to the dollar, subject to an adjustable rate mechanism. This then established stability in the international financial system for the post-war period, in particular following the restoration of currency convertibility in 1958. This monetary stability then lasts until the beginning of the 1970s, when we had the collapse of the fixed exchange rate mechanism. President Richard Nixon announced on 15th August 1971, as part of a larger new economic plan for America following the Vietnam War, that the gold window would be closed, which meant that countries around the world could no longer exchange dollar bills for gold bullion. This then ended the fixed exchange rate mechanism, and we went on to floating rate currencies. There was an attempt by a committee of 20 to design an alternative system, 1971, 72, 73, that failed, and therefore we moved on to fully floating currencies, which was recognised by the International Monetary Fund at an amendment meeting in Jamaica in 1976. This then creates the international world order within which we currently live, with floating currency rates, interest rate volatility, and all of the other associated market, cyclic, and other movement effects that arise. We then have two economies. We have a global mercantile economy, a trade-based economy for the sale of products and services, and then a separate global finance economy around that. We can identify all of the key markets within this. We have the banking markets, primary money market, secondary money market, with the euro dollar markets, with the capital markets, including the bonds, notes and commercial paper market. We have a structured finance market, financial derivatives markets, insurance markets, gold and other commodity markets. I've provided just some idea of the valuations of each of the key financial assets and markets at this time. Total coinage and banknotes in the world is currently around $4 trillion. The value of all the bank accounts and banknotes together, $90 trillion. Equity trading, $37 trillion. Global stock markets, $95 to $105 trillion. Total global foreign exchange, over $6 trillion, which moves around the world every day. 65% of that market is in London. Eurodollar markets are worth over $223 trillion. Bond market, $128 trillion. Securitization, at least minimum $1.6 trillion. Total nominal derivatives are over $600 trillion. If we mark that to market, it's around $15.8 trillion. The difference simply is that many of the transactions in the financial derivatives area, the payment obligations are calculated with regards to larger gross amounts. That is not the amount that's actually ever paid. It's not the amount at risk. That's the $600 trillion. The amount at risk, the market value, is $15.8 trillion. And if we then use the finance documentation that's supplied on a daily basis in practice, including specifically the master documentation prepared by the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, ISDA, the 2002 Master Agreement, if we apply the two sets of netting provisions in that document, the total risk within that market reduces to $3.4 trillion. So through intelligent use of standard market documentation, we can reduce the risk in a $600 trillion market to $3.4 trillion. Insurance markets receive around $5.5 trillion in premia every year, which is then invested in all of the other markets on the table. That is expected to rise to around $6.4 trillion by 2025. Insurance companies are amongst the largest asset holders in the world. They receive premia, which is the payment against the insurance policies that they write. There can either be a single payment premia at the beginning, or there can be regular ongoing premia payments, for example, on an annual basis. All of those funds are invested in those other markets. They make up a substantial part of the bond market, the equity market, possibly bits of the Eurodollar market and other asset markets. Insurance companies, life companies, pension companies are amongst the largest asset holders in the world. They develop large portfolios of assets which generate income receipts, which generate earnings. It's those earnings that they use to pay for the liabilities under the policies that they write. We've also got the shipping markets worth over $14 trillion. The gold market currently is around $11 trillion. Silver market, $5 trillion. What is the world worth in total? Earlier figures before the global financial crisis placed the total value of all assets in the world at around $198 trillion. That was in 2007, 2008. This then collapses to around $172 trillion following the global financial crisis. The figures I saw subsequently, this increased to around $216 trillion, $250 trillion. The most recent figures value total global assets at around $431 trillion. That's made up of $250 trillion in financial assets, $235 trillion in real assets, $53 trillion in liabilities, which means we can deduct the two, the financial and the real, and that gives us a figure of around $431 trillion. That's expected to rise to $544 trillion by 2025, with $315 in financial assets, $296 in real assets, and $67 trillion in liabilities. We can then set the total value and worth of all of the assets in the world against total debt levels. Debt levels in 2000 were around $198 trillion. In 2010, $224 trillion. They then rose to around $281 trillion by 2020. If we deduct total assets of 431 by total debt of 281, we get a net figure of around $150 trillion. that effectively means that the total value or added worth that mankind has created over the last 10,000 years is around $150 trillion at some reasonable estimate. Total US debt is around $26.7 trillion. The Federal Reserve balance sheet is over $8 trillion. Before the global financial crisis, that was just over $1 trillion or just below $1 trillion. It rose to $2.25 trillion after the global financial crisis. And then around 2014, 2015, it rose to around $4 trillion. It's now over $8.5 trillion, including the cost of the global financial crisis. Total China government debt is around $7 trillion. Total debt in China is around $40 trillion, 303% of GDP. Could we have another financial crisis? What are the key triggers that could arise? What could lead to this? These are the key factors that we have to consider. We have massive historic levels of debt, as we've just referred to. Inflation is beginning to rise substantially in many economies across the world. We have the cost of the coronavirus crisis, impending cost of the climate crisis, possible other technological crises and losses to deal with. We have complex causation and emergence because markets are more interconnected and interdependent than ever before. We have a whole range of endogenous internal, exogenous external, and other existential risks to consider, as well as other more specific threats in particular markets. In China, the Evergrande property development company is about to collapse with debts of around $310 billion. China real estate total value is between $52 and $55 trillion. The authorities are very concerned that Evergrande could trigger a larger spiral of default in the Chinese real estate market. US commercial real estate is expected to collapse by around 70% this year. There's other difficulties with electricity supply in China, as well as with gas and electricity costs in the United Kingdom and EU. The biggest residual latent problem now is rising inflation. That will then create pressure on all of these other factors and all of the other markets across the world. We have to monitor this carefully going forward, with all of this then being further exacerbated by the continuing geopolitical tensions that arise, including, for example, with regards to Russia and Ukraine, as well as the relationship between America and Russia and the United States and China. We have to monitor all of this carefully going forward. It's all expected to have a major impact on international financial markets. In terms of the key markets and indices, we can understand the more detailed structure of the international financial system with reference to some of the key markets and key reference rates that professional investors will inevitably refer to. We have, for example, the S&P is the Standard & Poor 500 index in the United States. Standard & Poor was originally set up, this was 1957 when the index was established. It currently has a total market capitalization of around $42 trillion. The figure before Christmas, 2 or 3 months ago, was 4,350. Most of the American markets have gone down quite substantially. The United Kingdom markets have risen. The Asian markets are generally relatively flat. The Dow Jones is the related market in the United States. The Dow Jones Index was created in 1985. It has a total market capitalization of around $10.84 trillion. The NASDAQ is the electronic marketplace, an online digital market, which was originally established in 1971. Total market capitalization is around $19.4 trillion. The United Kingdom Financial Times 100 is the main reference rate. This was originally set up in 1984. It has a value of around just under $2 trillion. $1.814 was the last figure that I saw. The main index in Hong Kong is the Hang Seng, originally set up in 1969. It is a market capitalization of around $38.37 billion. The largest reference index in Shanghai is the Shanghai Composite. It was set up in 1991 with a total market capitalization of around $6.95 trillion. As I have explained, most of the American markets are down substantially just now. UK is up. Asian markets are relatively flat. We can also look at this in terms of bond market figures. The most commonly used reference rate is the United States Treasury 10-year bond. It was, before Christmas, 1.47. The German 10-year bond was down to 0.23%. UK 10-year bond was flat at 1%. Japan, 0.04%. In terms of the main foreign currency rates, these are always considered in pairs. The most commonly referred to include, for example, dollar sterling. The dollar sterling FX rate was around 0.74, dollar yuan was 6.45, dollar yen 110. In looking at markets, it's also very common to refer to the oil price, so oil Brent crude, and then the New York Mercantile figures. Oil was at 78, it was as low as 30, and it's now rising fast again over 80. We can also look at the price of gold. Gold was around 1763 per troy ounce. Silver is considered in kilos, 727. That sounds very high in comparison to gold, but that's because it's on a different measurement reference system. The other most common rates that are often considered are the volatility indexes. The most commonly used of those is the Chicago Board Options Exchange, the VIX, which is the volatility index. The VIX 2 or 3 months ago was 19.45. The VIX is now up to 28.85, and today it's risen again to over 32.16. This is based on the option prices on the S&P 500 on the top left, which means it effectively creates a 30-day rolling average of expected volatility in the markets. So when asset managers are attempting to try and understand how the markets may move over the immediate forward period, they will often refer to volatility indexes, including specifically the CBOE VIX. In terms of key trends within the markets in the post-war period, we can summarise these separately. With regards to post-war market development, markets have generally been characterised by massive cross-border expansion. This essentially begins with the banks in the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s. This will then extend into the securities markets, 1980s, mid-1980s, late 1980s, into the 1990s, as specifically telecommunications and computer software and hardware improved. So again, we've had massive advances in hardware and software support over the last 50, 60 years. Again, related advances in telecommunications. The larger deregulation of markets, which has also been associated with coming together, aggregation of financial firms at the same time as we have this associated deregulation. We've had the very significant emergence of increasingly larger complex groups. We call these financial conglomerates, or in German, Bank Affiance, or in French, Bank Assurance. Large banks come together, they take over each other or merge, and they begin to form increasingly larger complex groups. This was then extended to include securities firms and, more recently, insurance companies. Most of the major financial institutions now only operate as large groups, as part of even larger conglomerate systems, with many financial institutions being connected with many others in increasingly complex ways. All of this has then been associated with a larger deregulation of legal and regulatory requirements across the world, in particular with the opening up of capital controls, in particular at the end of the 1970s, the beginning of the 1980s, and which created the ability to move capital around the world much more effectively. At the same time, as we've had substantial improvements in cross-border payment systems and messaging systems, such as with the international SWIFT system. In terms of capital markets adjustment, we can consider this in terms of, during the 1970s, substantial expansion in securitization and credit markets. This followed the earlier establishment and then growth and development of the Eurodollar markets in the 1960s, specifically in the City of London. The dollar replaces sterling as the principal international reserve asset in the earlier 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. The ascendancy of the dollar is then confirmed under the Bretton Woods system, because we essentially create a dollar exchange standard whereby we fix the value of the dollar to gold and then all other currencies to the dollar. London will still emerge as the principal international financial centre following the Second World War, in particular with the transfer of dollar assets from New York and the other principal American financial systems into London. The light regulatory, highly professional nature and culture of the City of London continues to dominate in international finance, and it attracts investment from across the world, led by the American banks and financial institutions in the post-war period. London then re-emerges as the most significant international financial centre, effectively as a location, as an offshore centre for dollar debt. This is the beginning of the Eurodollar markets, in particular following the restoration of currency convertibility in 1958 after the restrictions imposed following the Second World War. The Eurodollar markets then grow very fast during the 1960s, into the 1970s and into the 1980s. Eurodollars principally consist of three key markets. There is an underlying interbank market where the banks can buy and sell money amongst each other. There is then a syndicated lending market whereby the largest banks and financial institutions can advance very significant amount of funds to governments and countries all around the world. This is usually on a group or syndicated basis, simply to allow the banks to spread the credit risk involved. It's not that they cannot provide the funds, because the funds just come from the market itself. They're simply borrowed by the banks in the market. It's that the banks want to spread the credit risk that would otherwise arise. Credit risk in the banking markets is the risk of counterparty default. That is that the borrower will not pay interest during term and repayment of principal on maturity. We then also create a parallel euro bond market, which allows issuers to create and issue into the market securities in the form of bonds directly, without having to go to a group of banks to borrow. The largest companies with good credit standing can issue new bonds into the market directly. The volumes of the euro loan market will then fall during the 1970s, beginning of the 1980s, by around a quarter, while the bond market increases by four times to more than compensate for this. Because of the additional liquidity and volume of funds in the bond market, issuers with good credit standing can usually generally borrow more and at lower cost through the euro bond rather than the euro dollar markets. Once these markets have been established in the 1960s, markets then grow and extend subsequently. We have the very significant expansion in securitization, with the transfer of assets from the loan market, the credit market, the banking market, to the capital markets. We then have the disintermediation of markets in the 1980s. Following securitization in the 1970s, we have further product innovation and repackaging in the 1990s. We have the privatization of markets, late 1990s, early 2000s. This is essentially concerned with the movement of borrowing and share trading from formal stock markets and exchanges into electronic and digital markets. This is also associated with the delisting of many large companies, in particular with the growth and rise of hedge funds and with private equity funds. Many of the largest companies are taken off formal stock markets. They're reclassified from being public to private companies at the same time as share dealing is taken off the formal exchanges, mainly because of the additional costs and then the regulatory obligations that apply with regards to public listed companies. So we have a substantial privatization in the markets. At the same time, we have a very significant increase in the sophistication of risk management. We essentially deconstruct risk. We break financial risk down into increasingly complex subparts, and we initially early had managed these separately. We then develop systems that can manage all of this on an aggregate basis. So we get the emergence and construction of very sophisticated risk management systems, which allow the construction of increasingly complex portfolios. This is partly supported by the expansion of the hedge fund industry and the sophisticated forms of new risk management techniques that they develop. All of this, in terms of market effect, we have increased market consolidation, market concentration, market innovation, market integration, and total aggregation of market value, but also of market risk. Following the global financial crisis, all of these processes have continued, but with some correction. So we had a significant point or period of market contraction and restructuring. We still had recovery in market competition and profitability over time. There was, however, a significant increase in market criticism and a certain degree of over-regulation. Many of the politicians and certainly media commentators had not understood the proper causes and intricate details that arose around the global financial crisis. We developed a basic, simple bank criticism, bank bashing culture. This then leads to a substantial increase in regulation. Many would argue that this resulted in a significant over market reaction and excessive re-regulation of the markets. The point simply being that some reform can always increase financial stability, but after a degree, after a period, this simply has the effect of limiting innovation and imposing increasing costs on all market users, including governments, companies, and households and retail individuals. Against that, we've had more criticism of the overly regulated state of many specific markets and then some additional deregulatory pressures. During all of this, we've had further market innovation, growth, and evolution. The main point to highlight is that the additional stability that was created following the global financial crisis, beginning 2007-2008, it then spreads and increases, metamorphoses into a sovereign debt crisis, 2009, 2010, 2011, 2012. Following all of the additional higher levels of regulation that are imposed, the markets are then more stable and in a condition that they can withstand the consequent coronavirus crisis beginning in 2019-2020. To a significant extent, the global financial crisis then creates the conditions within which we have much more stable, efficient, and effective markets, which allow the markets to support the government calls for additional funds to support coronavirus crisis response initiatives, and it's largely because of the stability in the financial markets that we have no further disruption in the markets with the coronavirus crisis, and that the financial system as a whole is able to support all of the necessary corrective measures which have to be adopted across society in response to the challenges created by the coronavirus pandemic. In terms of the larger condition and operation of the financial system, we can also consider this having regard to the US dollar market hegemony, which has arisen in the post-war period, in particular following Bretton Woods. 23% of countries' GDP is denominated in dollars, 12% of US trade is in dollars, although 60% of assets effectively exist in a dollar zone. We have certain management and investment imbalances with regards to dollar dominance. We have wild volatility, gyrations in dollar prices, in dollar asset positions. We lack an effective support system for the use of the dollar. There is no international global dollar lender of last resort, which can also then lead to hoarding, which can cause deficits of dollar use. There's also arguments of regulatory politicisation and the fact that this can also be weaponised in some respects. There's a very good article in The Economist on the dollar, referred to as dominant and dangerous. I can provide references to that. There are possibly solutions. We could increase US funding of the International Monetary Fund. These are the arguments developed by The Economist and other commentators. The United States could also surrender its veto on International Monetary Fund voting, effectively because the United States has, I think it's 16% of the IMF capital. It has a de facto veto. In practice, that's not going to happen. We could also extend swap lines to allow other countries to draw down on dollar funds. We could encourage large banks to move to New York rather than London. The key point is that London, as an international centre, attracted all of the substantial available free funds that were in the international financial system in the post-war period. Partly because of over-regulation in America, especially with a Regulation D and a Regulation Q, which imposed interest rate ceilings and capital reserves, very substantial funds further moved from New York to London, as well as the effect of United States sanctions and other countries being concerned with the safety and security of their dollar deposits in New York. Very substantial amounts of funds were moved from New York to London during the 1960s and early 1970s. All of the major international banks in the world then moved to London to establish operations in London. To some extent, the dollar dominance could be partly corrected if there was a further retransfer of positions to New York. There's also arguments that we could remove political and regulated interference, and other reforms could be adopted in terms of global governance, in particular through reform of the World Bank structure and the World Trade Organization system, with additional extensions. The two other main economies in the world are the European economy, managed through the European Union, and in China. The principal difficulties with Europe is that it still has not been able to establish a full banking union, and many call for the completion of this work and the development of a parallel capital union, although that's even more difficult in practice. Other commentators also call on the need to develop joint bond issuance, although many of the largest countries, including specifically Germany, resist this, although there's been some relaxation in that more recently. There's also been substantial study of the impact of the growth of the Chinese economy. It's continued to grow very substantially both before and after the coronavirus crisis. The Chinese economy can still play a very significant role in the international financial system. It could be of particular value in providing competition to other major economies, economic groups, including with the United States and Europe, although difficulties still arise with regards to political distortion and political interference. Recommendations are made to reform the Chinese system. We need to bring the renminbi into the SDR, which has been achieved, but we also have to remove other exchange controls. Commentators argue that the renminbi should be allowed to float freely. The difficulty is that it's alleged that the Chinese authorities still keep the renminbi very low in international markets to give China a very significant trade advantage. We also need to open public share ownership, in particular for government-owned securities, government-owned stocks. Shares are sold on, for example, the Shanghai Stock Exchange and in Hong Kong, but many of the core Chinese stocks are split and then reserved for Chinese holding and acquisition, with only the lesser quality stocks being made available to international investors. We also need to avoid political direct interference in the markets and all forms of political distortion. The main issue that arises is that publicly owned, publicly connected and publicly managed companies are given massive preference, which does not allow the private market to compete freely either within China or at the international level. Various other solutions have been proposed, for example, developing regional trade systems. There's over 450 regional trade arrangements which could be developed further. Clearly, the most developed and sophisticated of these is the European Union itself. We could develop other forms of dollar control, dollar reserve asset management. New forms of guarantee or support facility could be established. There is, for example, the Chiang Mai initiative that was originally set up on 24 March 2010. It's now has a membership, I think it's 10 ASEAN, that's the Asian Economic Community, 10 Asian members with China, Japan and South Korea. It makes available, it was $120 billion, that's now been increased since 2012 to $240 billion. It's a form of swap lines which allow Asian economies to swap currencies. The Chinese government has also promoted the establishment of the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. This is effectively a form of international monetary fund structure system for the Asian economies, or a combination of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. This was originally set up in January 2016. It now has 133 member countries, 16 prospective new members with $100 billion core capitalization. We could also look at further coordination of regulation and supervision at the international level, as well as the development of more clearly structured management arrangements in place of earlier sporadic patchwork disconnected initiatives. There are residual remaining difficulties within the international financial system. The principal threat is one of fragmentation, with China and America possibly completely dislocating. That would be against everyone's interest, and significant work has to be undertaken to attempt to manage this more effectively in practice, so that we can establish an effective, stable, sustainable international financial system and international financial institutions, which can then support common further global challenges going forward. In terms of the costs of recent crises, Bear Stearns in America was the initial cause for the global financial crisis. It collapses, it's closed down on a compulsory basis. Well, it was strictly speaking on a voluntary basis, although effectively at the very strong suggestion of the authorities in the United States. This was the morning of Monday, 15th March 2009. This was the Lehman closure on 15th September 2009. Bear Stearns had earlier been purchased by JP Morgan Chase using a $30 billion facility made available to the Federal Reserve. Bear Stearns was the fifth largest securities firm in Wall Street. Lehman Brothers was the fourth largest securities firm in Wall Street. Bank of America, instead of purchasing Lehman, purchases Merrill Lynch, which was number three on Wall Street, and the holding companies for Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, the second and first largest firms in Wall Street. They re-register as bank holding companies so that they can obtain dollar reserve lending facilities from the Federal Reserve System. The total costs of the crisis in America were estimated to be around $2 trillion for the government itself. $4.6 trillion more generally, and 15% of GDP. Markets were supposedly to have lost around $8 trillion, with total wealth collapse of $9.8 trillion in the United States alone. In the United Kingdom, the total commitment and costs, including all of the guarantees and other facilities made available, was as high as $1.162 trillion. Although once the government received all of the repayments and then all of the realization of the subsequent disposal of shares that had acquired, it also generated substantial recovery. The total costs I've seen as low in terms of net figures as $20.5 billion. Total global economic damage in terms of downturn in international markets was estimated at $2 trillion, although that may be far too low. In terms of the global coronavirus crisis, this originally arises from the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which causes the COVID-19 infection. This begins in Wuhan, China. It was thought that this arose in the Huanan seafood market, although it's more likely that it came from the virology laboratory in Wuhan and then was only spread through the Huanan seafood market. Since then, unfortunately, there have been 236 million cases of coronavirus infections across the world and then 4.83 million mortalities at the end of 2021. Total costs to the UK government were estimated to be around $317 billion. Total global costs are in excess of $16 trillion. The main issue now is further variants. We had the Alpha variant, the Kent B.1.17. We had the Beta, that's the South African B.1.351. The Gamma, Brazil P.1. The Delta, India B.1.617.2. And then now we're dealing with the Omicron. The United Kingdom has significantly relaxed all restrictions in this area going forward from, I believe, 27 January 2022. It just remains to be seen whether all authorities can contain all variants going forward. The next impending major shock that has to be considered is the global climate crisis, in particular following the COP26 Conference of the Parties in Scotland in November 2021. It's estimated that the climate costs could be anything between $140 and $300 billion per year to 2030 and then $280 to $500 billion to 2050. Total global disasters between 2016 and 2018 cost $605 billion. Total global GDP through climate effects could be 37% lower. Total estimated costs are in excess of $7.9 trillion. Other estimates place the cost of correction anything between $300 billion and up to $50 trillion if no action is taken. We then have not just the coronavirus crisis, we have possible other future exogenous and existential threats, and we can construct a basic exogenous risk model. We could have possible further future biological pandemics, in particular with new variants. We have natural planetary effects, earthquakes and tsunamis, climate impacts, principally through floods and droughts, infrastructure failure, energy failure and the collapse of the internet, possible other technological failure, defect, loss through artificial intelligence and robotics, and then continuing warfare threats. Laws are lethal autonomous weapons, in particular with regards to the continued emergence of biotech and nanotech. We still have all of these possible impending further issues to consider in attempting to determine the future stability, impact and condition of the international financial crisis. Provided we identify all the possible relevant sources of threat, we should be able to take appropriate action. We can only hope that it is possible to do so and that the necessary political will is there. We have one future, we have one opportunity, we have one common responsibility.